From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
One of the things that worries us about dying always is we're afraid we're leaving people behind and they won't be able to take care of themselves. We have to take care of them. But in fact, you see, I'm not leaving anybody behind.
That was Joan Didion on Fresh Air in 2005, after the publication of her memoir about her husband's death, The Year of Magical Thinking. About 2 months before our conversation, their only child, Quintana Roo, died at the age of 39. Today we talk to Didion about her new memoir, Blue Nights, a reflection on her daughter's life and death, and Didion's fears about her own shortcomings as a mother. Also, we hear from British actor Bill Nye. He plays an intelligence agent in the new film Page 8, which will be shown Sunday on public TV. He's also appeared in Love Actually and the BBC series State of Play. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joan Didion has spent the past few years reporting on her grief. Her best-selling memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, was about the year following the death of her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunn. He died at the very end of 2003 of a heart attack at the age of 71. At that time, their daughter, Quintana Roo, was in the hospital in a coma, suffering from pneumonia and septic shock. In August 2005, just a few weeks before the publication of The Year of Magical Thinking, Didion's daughter died of pancreatitis after spending much of the preceding 2 years in ICUs. Now Joan Didion has written a memoir reflecting on her daughter's life and death and on what she fears were her own shortcomings as a mother. It's called Blue Nights, and it's about a period when Didion says she found her mind turning increasingly to illness, to the end of promise, the dwindling of the days, the inevitability of the fading, the dying of the brightness. Joan Didion, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you again. Before we talk about your book, I'm going to ask you to do a short reading from it. And you're welcome to introduce this or to just begin, whatever you prefer.
When I began writing these pages, I believed their subject to be children, the ones we have and the ones we wish we had, the ways in which we depend on our children to depend on us, the ways in which we encourage them to remain children, the ways in which they remain more unknown to us than they do to their most casual acquaintances, the ways in which we remain equally opaque to them, the ways in which our investments in each other remain too freighted ever to see the other clear, the ways in which neither we nor they can bear to contemplate the death or the illness or even the aging of the other. As the pages progressed, it occurred to me that the actual subject was not children at all, at least not children per se, at least not children qua children. Their actual subject was this refusal even to engage in this contemplation, this failure to confront the certainties of aging, illness, death, this fear. Only as the pages progressed further did I understand that the two subjects were the same.
That's Joan Didion reading from her new memoir, Blue Nights. I get the feeling you wrote this book because you couldn't write anything else, because all you could think about was the death of your daughter. And
that's right. I didn't actually want to write it. And as I said in that passage I just read, I had some dim idea that it was a much less personal book than it turned out to be.
And, you know, combined with the grief that you have for your daughter, you're also feeling the frailty that comes with aging, and you have a lot of nerve pain that you've been experiencing. So you've had like the total package, you know, physical and emotional pain at the same time. Do you tend to be obsessive about physical pain or emotional pain?
Well, I try not to be. Let us put it that way. But it doesn't always work out.
If you're trying to examine that pain, whether it's your physical pain or your grief, and report on it in a book, does it put some distance between you and the grief or you and the pain because you're standing back and examining it and describing it?
Well, I myself have always found that if I examine something, it's less scary. You know, I grew up in the West, and we always had this theory that if you kept the snake in your eyeline, the snake wasn't going to bite you. And that's kind of the way I feel about confronting pain. I want to know where it is.
Your daughter Quintana died in 2005, 6 weeks before the publication of your memoir about losing your husband.
Right.
And when the book was published, the book about your husband was published, and I interviewed you, you said that you hadn't yet started mourning for your daughter. Could you only
I don't think I started mourning for her until I started writing this book.
Could you only do one at a time?
Definitely, I could only do one at a time. And I couldn't in any way
confront the death of my daughter for a long time.
Why?
Because she was adopted. She had been given to me to take care of, and I had failed to do that. So there was a huge guilt.
What do you mean you failed to do that? I mean, a parent can't protect a child from death.
But don't we all try?
Sure.
We try to keep our children safe. That's pretty much what parents are put in this earth to do.
Now, you said that when your husband died, it was like losing part of yourself. He could complete your sentences. He could be your protection from the world. But when your daughter died, it raised so many questions for you about responsibility and guilt. Were you a good mother? Did you adequately protect her? One of the things I think you fear that you were at fault for was not picking up on how troubled she was.
Of course. She was much more troubled than I ever recognized or admitted, because she was, at the same time that she was very troubled, she was infinitely amusing and charming. And that's naturally what I tended to focus on. I say naturally because I think most of us go through life trying to focus on what works for us. And her amusing side definitely worked for me.
But she had been diagnosed with depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, borderline personality
the whole gamut.
And looking back, you think you maybe could have seen that earlier?
I certainly could have seen it earlier. I don't know what I would have done about it. I mean, what we can do, what we can see and what we can do about what we see are two different matters for parents usually.
And I think an example you give in the book is that she had an assignment to write a journal. It was a school assignment. And she gave it to you to edit. And you were kind of like line editing it, suggesting different words, when you realized you weren't paying attention to the pain that she was expressing in this journal.
Exactly. Which is kind of the way we tend to deal with our children. We don't. Later we realize that maybe we haven't been listening to them at all. I mean, we've been listening to the very edge of what they say without letting it sink in.
You adopted your daughter after trying to conceive for a couple of years. You were 31 when the adoption came through. But for years before that, you were adamant about not getting pregnant. You so much didn't want to get pregnant. What changed your mind?
It just came over me and suddenly. I could almost date it if I remembered what year it was. I had to have a baby. I started cutting out pictures of babies from magazines and sticking them on the wall in my bedroom. I have no idea why that came over me at that moment. But it became really necessary. And then lo and behold, a baby was in my house.
Yeah, you got a call from a doctor who was,
an
obstetrician gynecologist?
Gynecologist, yeah.
Yeah, and who delivered the baby. And the mother wanted to give it up for adoption, and you became the mother. So after you got the call, the baby, you know, Quintana remained in the hospital for a couple of nights. Those two nights, you say you had dreams about forgetting you had a baby, leaving the baby in the drawer, and then going out to dinner without making provisions to feed her.
I had dreams about leaving the baby uncared for while I did something that I would have done before she was born. Like, decide to stay in town for a movie and stay for dinner. And all of these things that we do without thinking before we have children, and then suddenly we don't do them anymore, and it comes home to us in a real way that it's very different to have the responsibility of a child.
And you're right, too. This is right before you took home the baby. What if I fail to take care of this baby? What if this baby fails to thrive? What if this baby fails to love me? And worse yet, what if I fail to love this baby?
You know, that's something that we don't talk about very much, but almost everybody I know who has ever had a child is afraid before the baby comes that they won't that they won't like the baby or love the baby, that they won't be up to it.
So what was the reality for you when you brought Quintana home? Did you still fear that you wouldn't love her? Did you still fear you'd leave her
that.
In the drawer?
No. It was, the reality was actually couldn't have been more perfect. I remember driving, leaving the hospital with her and driving. We were living in, down on the beach then, and we were on the San Diego freeway going home. And I always thought of myself as bonding with her on the San Diego.
My guest is Joan Didion. Her new memoir about her daughter's life and death is called Blue Nights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. So if you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Didion, and her memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, was about grieving over the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. Her new memoir, Blue Nights, is about the life and death of her daughter, Quintana Roo. Quintana was born in 1966, and this is like the early stages of the women's movement, and I think women then were working so hard to figure out what it meant to be a mother with still having some sense of equality and without giving up your work and the life and identity that you had created outside the home. Were you trying to figure that out for yourself?
Actually, no, I wasn't. It never crossed my mind that I would have to figure it out. I always thought I would be working, and I always thought that I would have a baby if I was lucky enough. So I wasn't as troubled by that. When I got troubled by it was when I realized I wasn't really doing it as well as I thought, as I had anticipated I would be able to.
You had planned a trip to Saigon for a magazine piece, and the trip was to take place shortly after you adopted Quintana. You didn't know that you were on the verge of becoming a mother when you accepted the Saigon piece. So you say that you had planned on going through with the trip anyways, bringing Quintana with you. You brought a beautiful flowered, silk parasol to protect her from the sun, and you realized that you were acting as if you were going, to a high-fashion place with her and that you weren't really dealing with the reality here.
Right. It was all going to be tea and lemon presses at Le Cirque Sportif. I wasn't seeing that there was an actual shooting war going, a bad, bad war going on, and we were really at the worst. This was 1966. We were kind of at the worst turn in it.
In the Vietnam War. And you say you realized you were raising Quintana like a doll. What do you mean by that?
She had a lot of... When I say I was raising her like a doll, I mean literally I was dressing her. That was my main conception of my role. I made sure that her clothes were taken care of. I dressed her. She was a doll to me, which in retrospect gave me probably a distorted idea of who she was. I didn't give her enough credit for being a grown-up person, even as a four-year-old. She was a grown-up person.
When did that change for you? When did you start feeling like she wasn't a doll and there was more than dressing her?
When she was 12, 13, when she was beginning to be in high school, then the reality of the this was a real person started coming through to me.
It's hard for me to imagine that when she was 10 and 11, you were still treating her as a doll.
Well, maybe less when she was 10 or 11.
I mean, children are so demanding. You know, it's hard to treat a child like a doll at some point because they're asking for things. They're insisting on things. They're crying. They're laughing. I mean, they're making their presence felt. They're willful.
Well, she was actually not a willful child.
Because your daughter had a cerebral brain hemorrhage toward the end of her life, and she was in a medically induced coma for a while, her memory was not good, her comprehension wasn't good because of these medical problems, you were, I assume, unable to talk about the things that you might have liked to talk with her about at the end of her life?
No, I was able to talk with her at the end of her life because she was very open about her fears and her condition.
Would it be an intrusion to ask what kind of things you were able to talk about and maybe resolve? Did you talk about any of the fears about your how you behaved as a mother, the fears you express in the book? Did you express any of those fears to her?
Once we talked about what kind of mother I had been, and she, to my surprise, said you were okay, but you were a little remote. Now, that was a very frank thing for her to say, and I recognized myself in it. I was a little remote.
You write that your daughter once expressed the fear that your husband would die and there would be no one but her to take care of you. And you
that was a scary moment.
When was that?
It was actually not long before she died. It was in the last few years of her life. But I had not realized how responsible she, how heavily she bore the responsibility of taking care of me, which hadn't occurred to me as a necessity.
You think it's because she saw you as frail?
I think it was because she saw me as frail.
And you see yourself as frail?
I certainly do now. I'm not sure I did then.
When you were younger and your husband and daughter were alive, did you ever expect you'd be facing the last years of your life without them, that you'd be left on your own?
No, I never did expect that. And I don't know why I never expected it, because, I mean, there was no reason to think that Quintana would be ill. But John had demonstrably had things that could kill him. He had heart disease that had undergone a number of interventions for heart disease, and eventually one of them wasn't going to intervene. But I didn't face this. I never had a very realistic view of everybody else's survival time.
Do you worry about being alone? Like, it sounds like you like being alone, but you hate being alone.
I love being alone. I mean, I need to be alone. I get terribly anxious and nervous if I'm not alone for a period of enough time.
Are there objects from your husband or your daughter that you actually want to look at every now and then and that bring back good memories, like helpful memories?
Yes. I have certain things of Quintana's. I have her, for example, some school uniforms and the pinafore that she wore for volunteering at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. Now, those are things that I feel very warm when I look at, and I wouldn't want to live in a house that didn't have room for those. So they'll be around.
You have been immersed in death, so Do you think, like with this book published and with your reporting kind of done, you'll emerge more?
Oh, I think so. I think it's. I mean, I'm feeling very strongly the need to do something in another vein. I don't know what that vein will be, but I want to find it.
Are you getting any pleasure in life?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
What's giving you pleasure?
Quite simple things. I mean, for example, yesterday I went to a concert and the music gave me pleasure.
Well, Joan Didion, I'm really glad we had the opportunity to talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joan Didion's new memoir is called Blue Nights. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the New York Community Trust, working with Lowell School to educate young people for a life of global citizenship in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Coming up, we meet British actor Bill Nye. He's co-starring in the new BBC movie Page 8, which airs this Sunday on public TV. Nye played a sardonic editor in the BBC series State of Play, was an aging rock star in the film Love Actually, the tentacled pirate in two Pirates of the Caribbean films, and was the voice of Whitey, the albino ex-lab rat, in the animated feature Flushed Away. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Bill Nye, is a respected actor in British film, TV, and theater, who's become better known to American audiences in recent years. In the 2003 film Love Actually, Nye played an aging rock star named Billy Mack, who's briefly revived his career by doing a sappy Christmas version of the Troggs hit Love Is All Around. In this scene, he's doing a radio interview about his comeback.
Billy, welcome back to the airwaves. New Christmas single cover of Love Is All Around.
Except we've changed the word love to Christmas.
Yes. Is that an important message to you, Bill?
Not really, Mike. Christmas is a time for people with someone they love in their lives.
And that's not you?
That's not me, Michael. When I was young and successful, I was greedy and foolish, and now I'm left with no one, wrinkled and alone.
Wow. Thanks for that, Bill.
For what?
Well, for actually giving a real answer to a question. It doesn't often happen here at Radio Watford, I can tell you.
Ask me anything you like, I'll tell you the truth.
The best shag you ever had?
Britney Spears.
Wow.
No, only kidding. She was rubbish.
That's Bill Nye in Love Actually. Nye has also appeared in The Constant Gardener, Notes on a Scandal, Pirates of the Caribbean, Shaun of the Dead, The Girl in the Cafe, and the acclaimed British TV series State of Play. Nye plays a British intelligence agent in the new film Page 8, which will be shown Sunday on Public TV's Masterpiece. Nye spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Bill Nye, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Page 8. This is the new film you've done, which is going to be shown on public broadcasting stations in the States. You play a British intelligence officer who happens upon a document that could lead to an international scandal and prove that the prime minister might have known or been complicit in some nasty things. And yeah. I thought we'd listen to a clip here. This is where you are talking to your daughter, who is played by Felicity Jones. She is an artist, and you're talking right after an opening of some of her work. And she's asking you what you thought.
For once in your life, you might try telling me the truth.
Only if you insist.
I insist.
All right, they look like works of despair. If the despair isn't real, then I don't like them because they're fake, they're unfelt, they're avant-garde protests and nothing more. But if the despair is real, then that hurts too because you're my daughter and I don't want you to suffer.
They're not fake.
That's what I thought.
So what bothers you? If I'm unhappy, then it's your fault they make you feel. Guilty, the absent father, the evasive father.
The pictures are morbid. They're morbid, Julianne. Okay, I can see it may be my problem to do with getting older, but why do you want to piss on life before you've even lived it?
I don't think you should say any more.
I was wondering.
Yeah.
That young man you were talking to.
Which one?
I think his name's Ralph. Ralph Wilson.
You're working. Hell, you're not even talking to me, you're working.
Oh, come on, let me take you home.
No. I don't want you anywhere near me. Do you have any honest relationships at all?
And that's our guest Bill Nye with Felicity Jones in the new film Page 8. I mean, you know, one of the reasons that I picked this clip was she says at the end to her father, your character, you're always working. And there's something about the mentality of a spy, somebody who is never off, always analyzing things from a dozen angles. I mean, how do you play somebody in that world?
Well, it's quite tricky because you are never wholly telling the truth. One of the difficulties about working in the intelligence services is that you can't even allow your family to know specifically about what you're involved in. And your children are amongst those who are excluded from knowing the facts of your working life. And the secrecy just goes on and on and on and kind of grows. And also, whenever you're speaking, you're only telling part of the truth. It makes it very satisfying as a part because it's quite it's complex and interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. Now that you mention it, when I listen to you in that part, you have this weight to your voice as if you're sort of burdened by all the deception in your life.
Yeah, I tried to give it a different kind of tone. The tone on any part is the difficult thing to hit, and I hope I established one that gave it some kind of so you can understand the burden of his responsibilities. He has a document, as you said, which incriminates the prime minister, played by Ralph Fiennes, and could lead to big trouble. We're in fact going to make two more of these films so next year, so the story will continue. So, you know, we laughingly refer to them as page 9 and page 10, but I'm sure they'll have some other title.
Yeah, it is only partially resolved. And there's this wonderful scene where you confront the Prime Minister, Ray Fiennes, and it's this raw power against intelligence. Must have been fun to shoot.
It was great to shoot, actually. And because it's David Hare wrote and directed the movie, as you know, and it's because of him that we can attract people like Rachel Weisz, Ralph Fiennes, Sir Michael Gambon. They came because it's David. And Ralph came and played a relatively small role, so he was there for 2 days and we were locked in a room together. It was truly exciting because the writing is fabulous and that particular scene is very powerful and beautifully put together. So it was very satisfying for both Ralph and myself.
We're speaking with Bill Nye. His new film is Page 8. We'll talk more after a quick break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Bill Nye. You might remember him from the films Love Actually and State of Play. His new film, which is going to be shown on PBS stations, is Page 8. You grew up in England. Your mom was a nurse, and your dad managed a garage, right? And your home was on the premises, is that right?
Yeah, as you might say in America, I was born in a gas station. I wasn't actually born on the premises. I was born in a hospital. But we lived in a house where if you opened our front door, there were the gas pumps, the petrol pumps, as we call them. And my first ever job was serving petrol.
And you left school at an early age, is that right, and left the house at times?
I did. I ran away from home under the influence of Ernest Hemingway's short stories and Bob Dylan's first album. And I went to Paris in order to write the great English short story or something. Didn't write a word, but managed to flunk all my exams. I left school around, I think I was either 15 or 16, which wasn't that unusual in those days for the kind of people around our way. You weren't expected to have any further education, really, in those days. It's all a long time ago. So I did leave school pretty early, yeah.
Actors can get typecast, and you have a very striking appearance. I mean, you're thin, you have these high cheekbones. I mean, some might call you patrician-looking. What typical roles did you get cast for earlier in your career?
Well, you go through phases, and it's often, if you play one part relatively successfully, you tend to get offered the same kind of role again. I used to play kind of working-class boys. I played army soldiers. I played, various kind of working class characters. And then at some point or other, I must have played a middle class part. And then I got a long run of middle class parts. And now I never really get asked to play much else, apart from, you know, when I get to play octopus people like Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean.
A unique role, to be sure.
Well, quite.
A journalist writing about you after an interview, she said, "You make everything seem so easy and amusing." And I have to say, looking at your performances, there is an ease about you. It just is as if this is just so naturally done. I gather from reading that acting didn't come easily to you.
No, it didn't come easily to me at all. And it took me a while to work it out, but I think I have a kind of a tendency to look relaxed, even though internally I'm kind of speeding on anxiety. I have a kind of anti-talent. I apparently look as if I'm relaxed, which I'm very, very, very grateful for, you know, because a lot of the time, particularly in the early years, I used to stand on stages kind of rooted to the spot, not knowing what to do with my hands and not knowing, you know, all the usual concerns for a young actor. You're not supposed to know what to do with your hands. You have to kind of learn what to do with your hands or what not to do with your hands. So, yeah, no, it didn't come easy to me. I was incredibly self-conscious. The great news for anyone trying to act who, you know, has average difficulty in, you know, trying to kind of stay calm is that they don't know what's going on in your head and you can operate whilst your head is attacking you.
Were auditions tough for you back in the early days?
Auditions were an absolute nightmare for me, yeah. I mean, they are for anyone. It's a horrible process. And one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, certainly, you know, professionally, certainly, and on a personal level, is that I don't have to audition anymore. And I can't tell you how thankful I am for that. I mean, sitting in those rooms waiting to go in on some cold winter morning and pretend to be a knight on horseback or something, or, you know, or go and have a nervous breakdown in front of people who don't smile, it's very, very tough.
Do you have a particularly memorable or forgettable audition?
I do remember for John Boorman, who is a great English director who made the movie Excalibur, Hope and Glory. He was a great English director. And he was very, very nice to me. But I did have to, in his living room, pretend to be on horseback. That means bumping up and down. And I had to pretend to have a sword in my hand and fight with Lancelot, I think. Or maybe I was being Lancelot. I didn't get the part, as is now, you know, if you watch the film Excalibur, I'm not in it. But it was one of those lonely moments. Also, I mean, I did a movie once called Still Crazy, in which I played another rock and roll idiot. And they got me up very early in the morning, put me in a disused tax office on the edge of London town, and they put me in a pair of velvet flared loon pants, which means they sit very low on your hips, gentlemen. I was 46 at the time, and they gave me a top which did not meet my trousers. They then put hair extensions on me and some very weird rock and roll makeup, put me in front of a karaoke machine, and played Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple. And I had to mime to Smoke on the Water. Luckily, I remembered that it was supposed to be funny. If I'm ever required to be, you know, people say be attractive or be charming or, God forbid, be sexy or anything, I go to pieces. But if it's supposed to be funny, then, you know, I think, you know, maybe I'm in with a chance. I did, you know, I did some high kicks in 4-inch heels and I ripped the trousers. I did a high kick and pretend to hurt my back. That's always a good one. If you want to get a cheap laugh, do a high kick and then pretend it's hurt your back. It's in the movie, actually.
So through the 70s and 80s, I mean, you developed a career. You got into television. You did some film. And I know that you developed a drinking problem, but you managed to keep working. I mean, did that hold you back at all, do you think, keep you from getting better?
I don't want to talk about this at length, but I will say a couple of things. And if you'll forgive me, I won't say anything further. One is that I didn't develop a drinking problem. I am one of those people who is built in such a way that I have, from the very beginning, an unfortunate relationship with alcohol. So there was never a good time for me to have a drink. And there's one further thing I will say, but I'd rather not say anything further just for reasons that we don't have to go into. It's not because I have any shame in this area. I'm a sober alcoholic. It's a perfectly respectable thing to be, and I've made arrangements about it. But I will say that I used to drink, and it was absolutely terrible. And now I don't drink, and it's absolutely marvelous. And that's as much as I'd like to say. Thanks.
I want to talk about Girl in the Cafe, a 2005 film that you starred in, written by Richard Curtis, directed by David Yates. One review said it's the best romantic comedy at a G8 summit you'll ever see. You play this very inhibited man, I guess in his 50s, who's kind of a high-ranking figure in the British finance office, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
The civil service, yeah.
Right. And you meet this young woman, who is played by Kelly MacDonald, at a cafe. And you're this very inhibited fellow, and a relationship develops. And I thought we'd play a clip here fairly early in the film where you're taking a walk and getting acquainted, and you're outside. You'll hear some ambient noise. I think you're walking by a river. And I believe you're telling her about a dream.
Well, on the whole, in my dreams, people are begging me to join the Rolling Stones. I'm sitting at home, and the phone goes, and it's Mick Jagger and Ron Wood together on speakerphone, I suppose, pleading with me to inject a bit of new blood into the band. Or I'm at the office and they say, someone's waiting for you downstairs, and I get in the lift down and there's Keith Richards waiting on the sofa in the lobby, and he gives me his guitar and says, come on, man, you have the music, play. We'll give as much heroin as you like. Just lend us your hot legs.
And that's my guest, Bill Nye, playing the lead in the film girl in the cafe. This character is just, if there's an opposite to the exuberant rocker that you play in Love Actually, it's this guy.
Yeah.
You want to talk about, I mean, there's a rhythm to his speech. How do you get this terribly inhibited guy?
Well, it's one of my favorite roles. It's something I absolutely understand. And also there is an element in it which reminds me of my father. My father was, he was not unlike him in terms of, he had a very uncertain kind of charm, but he wasn't overly sure of himself. He was a principled man and he conducted himself impeccably and was, and functioned, you know, very successfully in terms of his life. But he was undermined in a fundamental way. So it's not a portrait of my father or anything, but it is reminiscent of him. And it was, in my mythology, it was my kind of tender thank you to my father, because he's somebody I admire, and I admire anyone who is similarly undermined and yet they are victorious.
And when you say undermined, you mean what?
I mean what they would probably currently call self-esteem problems, or they would call, you know, a basic kind of insecurity where your head sells you a negative idea of yourself. And you have to work out that if you're lucky, that anything negative that happens in your head is probably a lie. But it doesn't stop manufacturing this kind of negative propaganda, and you have to operate anyway. So I find that kind of struggle, I find it very moving, and I found it very affecting in my father. And in that character, my father would incidentally kill me if he could hear me talking like this, but I mean it with all respect. And with that character, you know, it was very satisfying to play, and very satisfying to play with Kelly MacDonald, because she was so minutely responsive to everything you did. That's rarer than you might imagine.
I mean, were you undermined in that way? I mean, were you someone who's...
I had a whole kind of factory in my head, which with a lot of, negative propaganda machines working overtime. And I did have an anti-talent for describing myself negatively to myself.
Wow, not the kind of thing that you would think an actor would
well,
would
you'd
bear.
Be surprised, actually. I think you might be surprised. The people who are attracted to it often aren't the people you would imagine would be attracted to. They're not the gregarious ones. They're not the life and soul of the party. I know people who are household names who really have to put themselves through serious kind of discomfort in order to do their job. And, you know, they are rarely at peace with anything they've done. And it seems to be, I don't know that it's an equation that you have to be like that in order to be any good. I know that there is that terrible, irritating equation they come up with, which is that if you're not scared on stage, for instance, if you're not scared opening a play, you won't be any good. And I think that's probably true. If you're on stage with somebody who seems completely unconcerned, I think you're in trouble. That's my view. Well, you know, I know some great, great actors who, you know, they have no idea why they're... Sir Michael Gambon, who is in Page 8, is categorically a genius. I've seen him many times on stage and on film. He is one of that rare group who are, as they say, it's a cliche, but they are touched by genius. He doesn't know that. He doesn't want to hear me saying it. But he's not emboldened by that because he can't experience it. I can stand it, as I do often with Sir Michael, and I rarely use the, you know, you don't call people Sir this or Sir that. I mean, David Hare is Sir David Hare, but people don't. So with Sir Michael, I absolutely make a point of it because I think of him as one of the leaders, if not the leader of my profession in England. And, you know, like me, you know, he has to persuade himself that he can be an actor, you know, every now and again as well.
We're speaking with Bill Nye. His new movie is Page 8. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Bill Nye. He stars with Rachel Weisz in the new film Page 8, which will be shown on public television stations. I wanted to ask you also about State of Play, the British TV series 2003. You know, an American film was later made starring Russell Crowe. If folks haven't seen the British version, it's a terrific video rental. And Bill Nye, you play in this series, you play a newspaper editor, Cameron Foster. And the story surrounds the death of a woman who is the staff member of a member of parliament with whom the member might have been having an affair. And there are all kinds of sinister connections. And we're going to listen to a scene here in which a police investigator arrives and he's looking for reporters on your staff who have been looking into this murder, and they believe that your staff and your reporters may have information relevant to the investigation. You're the editor, and you're kind of trying to deflect their inquiries. Let's listen.
I'm not in the habit of lying. She's not here.
She's working on the Kelvin Stagg murder?
Correct.
With your chief reporter, Cal McCaffrey?
Also correct.
Is he here?
I believe not. Mr. Bell...
That's Detective Chief Inspector Bell.
If you want to talk to busy people, you make a date or risk disappointment.
You tell me the extent of their investigations into that murder?
No.
Well, you're their editor.
They haven't filed a story yet.
Oh, what, so they just, run around spending your budget without recourse?
Seniors do. I know, I don't like it. I'd rather be a dictator, but no one would work for me.
One of my officers was murdered. Don't piss me about. Now, Della Smith warned Stuart Brown that the patient he was guarding was a potential target for reprisals. Now, where did she get the authority to present that theory?
I could have. Well, my mother could have given you that from the TV reports. A gunman tries to kill a witness, but not quite. It stands to reason the motive for shooting the guy is still valid.
Well, she sought him out at 11 p.m. to tell him that.
You've met Della?
Interviewed her.
Beautiful woman, recently dumped by long-term boyfriend. It's a lonely job. Maybe she took a shine to your Stuart Brown. I really can't speculate. Well, I can. Obviously, I just have. But it's not helpful, is it?
And that's my guest, Bill Nye, from the British TV series State of Play. You want to just talk a little bit about this role?
Sure. It was a great role, and it went down very well, guess what, with journalists. And I had a couple of requests from journalists, one from the Times newspaper here and one from the Guardian newspaper in England, saying, could they come and work for me? Because they like that. I think that what journalists liked about it, and quite right too, was that they, for once, they were given an heroic role. And they were seen to be, you know, courageous and righteous. But it was a great role and a great series. And it was one of those, you knew you were in a hit, because people you hadn't heard from for years would phone up and say, what happens in the end? Because I'm going on holiday and I really got to know before I leave. You know, it became like a cliffhanger for the nation. So it was very cool to be in it.
There's a wonderful moment early in, I think it's the first episode, where there's a news planning meeting and one of your senior reporters kind of gets in your face and gives you a profanity-laced kind of barb. And then you say, oh, don't try that at home, kids.
Yes.
Right. You know,
that was a sweet one.
You bring a lovely touch of irony to a lot of this, and you have that little chortle. Are you a practitioner of deadpan humor in your private life?
I guess I am, yeah. I guess I that is my flavor of comedy. You know, that's my enthusiasm is for that kind of dryness is what I like, and it's what I enjoy watching in other performers. I like when humor is kind of buried. It's still effective, it still makes you laugh, but it's kind of disguised as naturalism, you know, as it's perfectly integrated into the story and into the dialogue and everything. You disguise it till the last minute. I remember when I did Girl in the Cafe, which had proper jokes in it, beautiful jokes, as you'd expect from Richard Curtis, but I'd just seen a film that became one of my favorite films immediately. It went in like top five, if not number one, which was called Punch Drunk Love.
Oh, yeah, Adam Sandler, yeah.
Yeah, and Emily Watson, and the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which I absolutely revere that movie. It's kind of, and one of the things I love about it is Adam Sandler's performance, because he's absolutely deadpan, and yet it makes you laugh. So I wrote the words Adam Sandler at the first page of Girl in the Cafe, because I aspired to the kind of undercover light comedy performance. That's what I like, where it's there are no concessions made to the fact that you're trying to be amusing. You don't sell it in any way at all. You do, but the audience don't get to hear about it until they laugh. That's as best as I can describe it.
Well, Bill Nye, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bill Nye spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Nye co-stars in the new BBC movie Page 8, which will be shown Sunday on public television. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the Great Tech War of 2012, we talk with Farhad Manju about how Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook are on the verge of war against each other. Manju's article about this is in Fast Company. He's a technology columnist for Slate. Join us.